Welcome to Supply Chain Next with your host, Richard Donaldson. Join us as we explore the ongoing evolution of supply chain, from the challenges professionals face every day to the ongoing digital transformation of the entire value network.
Welcome to the next episode of Supply Chain Next, and I am actually kind of just getting set up here, but really a pleasure to have me joined today is Reed Jackson of GS1. Good morning, Reed.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And like you and I were just talking pre-show, I should say we kind of our virtual green room before we go into the studio, if you will. But I had the pleasure of speaking to one of your colleagues, Vivian Tai, not too long ago. You are involved with GS1, and we're going to get into all of that. And, you know, just right off the gun, though, would love for you to just give a brief intro on just who Reed is, where you're from. And we're going to get a little bit into your origin story and kind of how you got into GS1. But go ahead, tell the audience who are you and what's going on out there.
Yeah, well, I'm a middle-aged bald guy living in America. I like to use some humor in it because I wake up in the morning and I'm like, wow, how did I get here?
It's the Talking Head song, man. You know, it's like right there.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But yeah, no, I'm one of four, growing up in a family in New Jersey for 40 years. And the last 10 I've spent here in Charlotte, North Carolina. I got my degree in environmental science from Rutgers University, Cook College, actually, to be specific.
Before you even move off that point, and I'm going to apologize up front, because when things pop up that I don't want to lose sight of, environmental science back in the early 90s, if I'm doing this right, because you and I are close to the same age, what was it like then versus what it is now? I mean, did you even have an idea of the environmental, you know, issues? I mean, they were still present back then, but maybe not as front and center as they are today.
Well, I would say that they definitely were. That's why I was involved with it. I wanted to kind of look at the interaction between business and the environment, and let's be harmonious. Let's work together and not in spite of one another or blind to one another. We still need to move forward with business. There's things that are happening, but we still need to be educated. You can't get paralysis at analysis type scenarios. But I remember even as a young boy in the 70s, the gas shortages and oil embargoes, and then happened to grow up next to a Superfund site. So I kind of, those things stuck with me, and it was like, well, wow, why are these things happening? And there was a lot of pollution then, and we even had some solar pushes back then. Yeah. So for me, I think the difference nowadays is YouTube and cell phones and the fact that we have video and you don't have to wait to learn about something in a book or a lecture or somebody else. You can search the internet real fast. And I think that that just really puts a good magnification and understanding. So like my kids, one's finishing up middle school and the other in high school, they know more than I do because of the access to information.
Yep. What about, and I'm going to let this one, because it's good, pun intended here coming up, but it's going to come full circle. Emphasizing back in environmental science, 30 some odd years ago, close to 40 years ago, what priorities were visible then versus what are the priorities now, right? Because it's the same generation.
Yes, that's an excellent point. I will tell you, today it's about sustainability.
Right.
Back then it was about pollution prevention, right? Yep. Let's get rid of the asbestos. Let's get rid of oil in the ground in hazmat areas. That was more of my studies were around that. It was, sick building syndrome and, water treatments and testing and Legionnaires' disease and all those types of things. And where today, I think the real topic is around sustainability.
Right. And okay, so then, but then, and it, as a twist of fate goes, you go to school, rah, rah, we're in college, we're doing environmental studies, not sure if you're going to join Greenpeace or not.
Right.
And then you go into technology sales.
Yeah. So I did it.
That happened.
So I did an intern my senior year with the United States Testing Company out of Weehawken/Hoboken, New Jersey. Loved it. They offered me a full-time job. I did that and I loved it. I was involved with some really cool things and some really eye-opening things because came out of college, frankly, pretty green behind the ears, you know, and I was literally on a job site where a gentleman came up to me and said, the place is clean, right? And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't even start testing yet. And he goes, son, the place is clean.
Oh, geez.
And I was like, oh, yeah. Okay.
And was this a Sony Soprano voice that he said that, or just don't want to?
I don't want to go any further into it, but yeah. So yeah. The interesting that happened as I was doing that, an alumnus from Rutgers had reached out to me and said, hey, I would like for you to, you know, meet with some friends I have here at Xera. And I'm like, Xera?
Yeah.
Copiers? I don't. He's like, Reed, just take the interview.
Yep.
And I'd say it was one of the best things that I ever did. It was one of the best decisions I ever made. I had no idea that Xerox had this research center in Palo Alto, California, famous park research center. I had no idea that Xerox was the inventor of Windows, as people know it. Touchscreen computers, the mouse, email, lots of, you know, really, really techie things. And I'm like, why are you teaching me all this when we're selling copiers? And then I quickly got into network printing. Before the time of people knowing what internet protocol was, this was Banyan Vines, Apple Talk, Token Ring, Novell Networks, all independent networks. So it was a wide area network and a local area network. And they didn't, you know, sometimes they didn't talk to one another. And so it just impressed upon me, Xerox was so professional. The training we got, I felt like I was in an MBA program. How to run meetings, the technology, negotiating, financing, just so much stuff. And while I was there, I came across Cisco Systems. And it was through, you know, some relationships from college, and a guy got me an interview, and I did the best I could to get in there because I didn't know half of what they were talking about. And
they didn't either, probably at the time.
Wow. I don't know. Their product catalog was pretty
Yeah, it's pretty, I'm teasing a little bit, but they're making it up as they go. But yeah, they did a great job, no question.
Yeah, well, back then, you know, my dad, he's like, hey, did you get a new job? I was like, yeah, I got a new job. I'm selling routers. He goes, woodworking goods? Said, no, Dad, these are internet routers, and they direct packets.
Yep.
You're in the mail business?
No.
But that was the mid to late 90s. Learned a lot from those experiences. I've been very fortunate to be on the cutting edge of a lot of different technologies and seeing them before they really moved into the mainstream. So.
And as you were moving through that, though, because you kind of then moved into some sort of executive search, which I'm going to open that door there for a second, right? That's sort of before you get into some other things, right? And I'm sitting here going, okay, and again, this is what's interesting here, and for people listening, is your path wasn't like kind of preordained. You weren't one of those individuals like born and said, I'm going to be a doctor, or I'm going to be an astronaut, and that's your lifelong mission. It's more, you kind of went with the flow. But you also gravitated and were lucky enough to be at the right place at the right time and make some right choices in that path. And, you know, people listening are kind of like saying, well, how do I get into these things? And this is kind of instructive, right? Like you didn't intend these things, but now reflecting on them, they all built you to who you are now. And we're going to get to that eventually, but how do you go from technology kind of sale, you know, environmental studies? Okay, technology at the time, yeah, why not? It's the mid 90s. I mean, the internet's literally exploding. Great time to get in, take a risk, and you learned the foundation of how the internet is literally built today. That knowledge, you know, stays with you forever. I mean, I can relate,
right?
Right? Like it is that packet switching technology that you learned back then is how the internet runs today.
Yes.
So you literally have the DNA building in your head of how the internet runs. A lot of people don't even know that, or they're going to school to figure that out. You learned it literally on the job, but then you traversed into recruiting.
Yeah. Yeah, you really did your homework.
Hey, I tried.
So if I'll tell you what happened. I was thinking I was middle-aged, being in my 30s, right?
So third, now, of course, right. Yeah. And now sell that with a smile at the 40s.
Yeah, it's a quarter life crisis.
Right.
Quarter life crisis, right?
Right.
And, you know, now I look back and, you know, I can literally just point out like, oh, I'm in this stage of my life now. And I was in that stage of my life. So what happened there was I was getting a little impatient with what was happening around me and what I wanted to do. And I wasn't doing things necessarily the right way. Like when I look back, people are like, oh, you got to go network. Oh, you're a good networker. No, I'm a good connector. That's what I am. A networker is someone that really builds these strong relationships to help themselves move forward and through. It took me a long time to learn that. I never asked people for significant help. I wanted to do it on merit. And I didn't share with people what my real goals were. And when I mentor folks now, I'm like, if you're networking, you need to share with people what your goals are. You really do. I never did that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I just kind of. So what happened was I literally wrote 3 business plans in a year.
Okay.
And one was a concierge service for college students, because in New Jersey, there are a lot of colleges very close to one another. And I was going to do laundry service, snacks, water, drinks, and just have this concierge service. That was one. The other one I wrote was, we called it the Rat Pack, and it was online storage for all personal digital content, okay, offered through insurance companies.
All
right. So if you had a house fire, how do you get this? So, and it was to tie it up. I didn't have the guts to ask for $10 million in funding because Google eventually did it with Google Photos, and Amazon offers it up and those types of things.
But you know what? But hold on. Cause now you I got a T on this one here. Cause I was at eBay for 5 years. And one of the things they decided to do back around similar time frame, kind of early 2000s after they launched, was to develop a phone app that then could digitally image all of your home assets and create an asset registry. And to this day, the idea of a consumer asset management system still does not exist in the way I think you're thinking about. Ironically, at GS1, you're solving some of that, and we'll get back to that. But it's still a giant open item. And my God, insurance companies should be paying through the nose to have that kind of data. In fact, they would even give you money per household you go do that. So open question to you is, looking back on that and thinking where we are today and that gap still exists, how come no one has solved that?
I think it's a bit more complicated. And I think that we're not willing to do the work that's outside, because there's some things happening. Let's not kid ourselves. The smart TVs collect a lot of data, both digitally and visually.
Yeah.
You know, I just read an article about, believe it or not, our cars gather more information on us than anything.
Yeah.
And they sell the information about our sex lives. And I'm sitting here going, wait, what?
Okay. So now you gotta help me. You gotta help me with that one. Like, how do you make
some cars are listening to the conversations you're having on when your phone's connected. Most people don't realize that, but that's in.
Well, there. Sure, yeah, that's in Alexa, Google Voice. I'm just kidding, because again, I mean, anytime you throw sex out there, it's like, all right, well, it was always God's name is.
Helen was like, okay, I'm interested. I'll read the article.
Yeah, right. That's why I'm like, I'm double clicking, right? That's clickbait.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
what?
Read the article.
But yeah. No, I'm with you on that one. I mean, I've known. In fact, I had one of the heads, he was early stage Tesla supply chain guy on. And he, you know, I know for a fact that the terabytes of data that car is collecting, not only the car itself, but everything that's going on around it. I mean, that's one of the things that most people don't realize is Tesla, you know, it makes automobiles for giggles, but it's really a data company.
That's right. It's a loss leader.
Yep. Yep. It is. Okay. Let me
kind of circle some things here. So I was writing these things and I was excited but I honestly didn't have the guts or the connections or the patience to ask for all this money. And so while I'm writing all these things, I had a recruiter call me and was like, hey, Reed, I have this perfect position for you. And I was like, I forget the guy's name at this time, but you know, for argument's sake, Mike. I'm like, Mike, you just placed me in the position I'm in. Like, you're already trying to place me out. And we started talking, and he's like, you should be a recruiter. You would be fantastic at this. And so a guy I worked with at Xerox, we started the same day together.
Right.
When I left to go to Cisco, he left to work with his dad at their family-run executive search firm. So I'd called him, and I realized, wow, they actually make a lot of money. And so I looked into it, and it was, you know, to get into it, there wasn't a high barrier. And I had already had a strong network, and I had a good understanding of what people wanted and what people needed. And so I went for it, and I created a niche, a real small niche of two types of positions that I would fill. And I did that for 8 years.
Killer. What kind of positions? Just out of curiosity.
Did technical salespeople and yep. technical pre-sales systems engineers.
Okay.
I filled the positions that I was in.
Yep.
You know, and I would really help the hiring managers filter through all the resume mess and all of that and get them exactly what they wanted.
Okay. The challenge. Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say the challenge for me is after a while, it became Groundhog's Day. I anticipate this is what they're going to say. This would
be it.
And I had about five companies I helped take from a 20-person company mm-hmm. to a 1,200-person company. And once they got in there, they had their own HR, their own internal recruiter, and I had to start over with other folks. And so my wife one day, she goes, you don't seem happy. And I'm like, kind of bored.
Yeah.
She goes, I was waiting for that. And so I went back into corporate America. I went to work for Splunk. Loved their technology, still love their technology. And guess what? Cisco just bought them.
I was just about to say, when I looked Splunk and then it goes back to Cisco, you kind of went back to the well, as it were.
Yeah.
Splunk obviously gets acquired later down the line from Cisco. I knew a bunch of people early developing at Splunk. But again, it's like, but you shifted back into a different function now after having 6, 7, 8 years of recruiting and building teams, because now you're a different kind of, now you know how to scale almost from an HR perspective, which is really a unique lens that most, I would even argue, venture capitalists still don't know how to do that to this day.
So,
they say they do, but they don't understand it.
I think a lot of people are taught, like, pick one thing and be an expert in that one thing, right? And the one thing, well, what is it? Is it the vertical? Is it the horizontal? Is, you know, what is the one thing? I kind of just got lucky. You nailed it, Richard. Like, I got lucky. I made some good choices. I made some bad choices. We all learn along the way. I went to work for Splunk. I loved it. And then Cisco called me, recruiting me for a job. And I still had a lot of friends that worked at Cisco. And I laughed when they called. And they're like, hey, we had this analytics piece to get into. And you have to understand, like, I stayed in IT that full time. When I was recruiting, it was for IT. Like, I'm 25 plus years in IT, looking at different angles and understanding different challenges. And when Cisco said, hey, we want to do something within analytics, I was drinking a glass of water and spit it out. And I laughed.
Yeah.
I'm like, you guys don't do anything. I said, you are the Xerox of the PC computer age. You have so much analytics, but you're not collecting it because you were selling hardware. And they're like, that's exactly why we want you to come back. And so long story short, came back, went and talked with them, did some things. And then an opportunity came up with a product called Tetration. And that was the cat's meow for me at the time. Like, black ops, sell it internally, sell it nationally, sell it globally, changing the way we approach the market. Similarities to things that have been tried the last 30 years, but you had to take a completely different approach, which meant a different go-to-market approach. And that was fun, and did that for 3 years. We had such great success with that product at the time. And then, okay, now it's mainstream. You're in the monster of Cisco, right? It's not a small team. It's a big team. And now it's global. Anybody can sell it, you know, all those things. So it was, what do you want to do next? And it was at that time where an old boss at Cisco had called me up. Hey, Reed, I saw you had a great year, blah, 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 blah. What are you thinking of doing next? Are you going to stay? Are you going to do it? I said, that's so funny you ask. I said, I'm just starting to pick my head up to look around.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, internally, externally? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, just going to start looking around. She goes, I have a friend from a previous life who has an opening, and I think you two should talk. And I'm like, great. You know, trusted advisor to a trusted advisor. And so I went and looked up GS1, us.org. And I immediately called my old boss back and said, you sent me the wrong website. She goes,
thanks.
Which one'd you go to? I said, GS1US.org. She goes, no, that's the right one. I said, it's a not-for-profit. Now, meanwhile, I've just been getting done driving a product from zero to a few hundred million and, you know, try to go after, you know, growth. And she goes, take the call, Reed. And so I spoke with Melody Noose, who's Senior Vice President of Innovation and Partnerships. And she's like, I'm really looking for someone that can take a look at the intersection of technology and standards and see where we can lean in more, where we may potentially have to take a different approach, or where we shouldn't play at all. And at that juncture, they were doing a lot with blockchain, which was hot off the presses, computer vision, QR codes. And I'm like, this is it. So I don't have to sell anything. Like, no, we just need to have conversations, build awareness, get educated. I'm like, this is a great transition for me. This is like, perfect.
Yep.
So I jumped in, but now here I am 5 years later, and I'm not looking at it as a transition period. It's like, this is really cool stuff. And I am bringing, like you said, 25 years of experience from technology, which, by the way, uses standards day in and day out, and then helping supply chains kind of understand this. And let's be honest, supply chains are trying to get digital every single day, automation every single day. But they, in some cases, just like all of us, I'll be the first to say it, we don't know what we don't know.
Yep.
This is where we can learn from.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So great. I mean, that's an incredible segue. And you've teed up the whole GS1 kind of thing. It's, you know, a throwback to Vivian's episode when we talked to her about that. Been a fan of GS1 back to my days at eBay, even when we partnered with you there for consumer standards. I'm going to come back to that. But another interesting question. So thinking back now a little bit, you know, I believe if I've got my timing right, you were at Cisco, or at least around Cisco during those years when the transition from Chambers to Robbins happens.
Correct.
John Chambers to...
That was my second tour.
Chuck Robbins, right? So the question I have, though, is because Cisco is... It was such a different company under John Chambers, and Chuck Robbins is... I mean, it's almost like Steve Ballmer and Satya Nadal at Microsoft. Right. I mean, it's profound changes in the leadership that also I would make the argument is why those companies maintained relevance, because both Chambers and Ballmer were great people for the time, you know, and both ironically were hardcore enterprise sales. Right.
Yep.
And therefore, everything in the company was tuned sell. And that's where the resources, everything else went into. Everything else was a distraction, including collaboration, open source, things that we now all talk about. And so the question with Cisco is, looking back on that, recruiting and all your experiences, you know, what are your thoughts on being at a company like Cisco, seeing that transition, and how impactful someone like Chuck Robbins and his philosophy towards partnerships, and I'm going to even say circularity. I mean, Chuck opened up the door to rebuy back all Cisco products where John Chambers never allowed anybody to do that.
Correct. I think you nailed it. It was the time. It was right for the time, and that's why you needed to make the change, because change was happening. It was happening without us. I mean, let's be honest. Cisco was late to the cloud market.
Yeah.
Very, very late to it. And if you're not growing, you're dying type scenarios. And the way we do business today, like to be an entrepreneur today, oh my gosh, like what a time in the history of the world to be out there. We're seeing things that we just didn't think of, because to be an entrepreneur in 1990, you needed to have a few hundred thousand to $1 million before anyone would even talk to you. Nowadays, you want to be an entrepreneur, you got $100, you jump online, you know, Fiverr and all these other types of things and leveraging it. And people are growing $1 million businesses in months. And it's very exciting times to be a part of, but also still, just like everything else, challenging.
Yeah, challenging, true. And I guess I'm going to triple click on the question a little bit, because I think there's a big philosophical change that happened somewhere in that period to where we are now. I mean, it's almost like there's different rules of engagement today, especially with your background in corporate development, partnerships, now visibility. And it's really going to be the key to digitizing the entire supply chain. And I'm going to come back to that with GS1 and all the work there, because people have to open up to data share today, right? And I think there's a philosophical story to outline the leadership changes and the companies that are well positioned today for that collaborative data sharing exercise, because he who data shares best will win, right? It's not the Machiavellian, you know, scarcity mentality. You got to get rid of that. And there's still, I mean, I'd say we're overweighted in that mentality still to this day.
So they say in life, there's two guarantees, death and taxes. I think there's three guarantees, death, taxes, and change. And, you know, like I have three kids, I'm blessed with them. And when I look at my oldest son, I see myself. And when I look in the mirror, I see my father. And it's tough. It's a weird transition, you know, like I'm realizing I'm a middle-aged man now, and I still have some thoughts, but you have to change. You have to evolve. The world prior to COVID, we've been having conversations since 2021, 2022. We're like, do we even look at the data prior to 2020 of March 2020?
Yeah.
Because is it even relevant anymore? And it, some of the data is definitely relevant. Some of it is just not. The world has changed. Fundamentally, we have changed. The way we go about a lot of things, but you nailed it, Richard. The way we share data, there's still, oil, data is gold. Data is what I want. Right. Yes. But as the old proverb goes, if you want to go quietly, go alone. If you want to go far, go with a group. And this is that sharing, but there's still trust, transparency to a point. You know, like you could just sit in any boardroom meeting and marketing folks want to do one thing, product wants to do another thing, compliance wants you to do neither.
Yeah, right. Right. So let's lead in though, because now that really opens up the door to what GS1 is doing. And I mean, fundamentally, even as a nonprofit, right, you know, opening your eyes to the fact that, you know, you can go into the nonprofit world and still make a decent living and have impact. It's just your company is not making profits. That's the only difference, right? Not only, but I'm simplifying it. And then secondly, you know, a little bit of history, and just take a second here, because I think I just want to refresh people on who GS1 is, right? And as someone, as yourself, as the VP of Innovation and Partnerships, right, which is a great, you know, add-on to Vivian's interviews, you know, you're leading kind of, you know, how to get GS1 out there, partner, you know, its mission statement to sort of, I'm assuming, kind of tag everything in the known world, create those standards so that we can track all that. I mean, at the end of the day, you're kind of leveraging, ironically, some of your packet switching technologies, where I have a unique identifier for everything on the internet. We have to take that model and extend it to the physical world. And that's the challenge in front of us that GS1, I think, is solving. But go ahead. Let me let you describe what it is.
Yeah. So let me just take a second in case there's some listeners that might not know who GS1 is.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So GS1 is GS1 US is this governing not-for-profit organization for US members. GS1 as a whole is a federated organization globally. So we have over 114 what we call member organizations. So GS1 US is a member organization, GS1 Canada, GS1 Mexico, GS1 Germany, you know, and so on down the line. And the reason is for that is because laws, regulations, tax filings are all different in every country. So we kind of have to manage that. But the standard is leveraged globally. So if you get a UPC in the United States or a UPC in Germany, they're going to be used interchangeably. And it's a lot more complicated than that. But fundamentally, GS1 does three things. We identify companies, we identify things or the products they make, and we identify locations. And that information is then utilized within supply chains. Mm-hmm. And we're actually technology agnostic. A lot of people think we're the barcode company. And yes, we were involved with the creation of the UPC barcode. You see it at every checkout. It goes beep when you go to checkout. And that was done 50 years ago by the grocery industry in the United States, reducing the queue lines, the checkout lines. Byproduct is saves money, saves time, increases customer satisfaction, but it also affected the inventory. Now they can have a better, you know, a collection of this inventory. Now we can extend it to distribution centers and to our partners and so on down the line. And nowadays, in 2023, we're leveraging UPCs, we're leveraging RFID tags, we're leveraging QR codes, we're leveraging computer vision, we're leveraging blockchain, we're leveraging so many other things. But it really comes down to, again, is this identifier to say, oh, this is product X from company Y at location Z. And right. Now you have context.
Right.
And I tell folks, they're like, oh, yeah, no, that's, I'm like, I always thought it was really simple. It's just blown out the back of my brain, the complexity to this. And believe it or not, standards that are smaller or shorter in nature are more flexible than ones that are very complicated and long. That was like blew my mind type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when we start to think of this, is it is very analogous to, I need a MAC address for this PC that has an IP address that can then send email and do other things.
Right.
And now where we have the IoT, right, which John Chambers kind of coined that term IoT way back when.
Yep.
And started driving that. And when we started the public internet, or as George W. used to call it, the interwebs.
Yeah, right.
Right. When we started that, we thought we had enough addresses.
Well, it's IPv4 to IPv6, man. You're hitting me up here, dude. I actually had an IPv6 startup pre-2012.
Yeah.
So about 15 years too early, and it never manifested into a good business opportunity because, you know, as you well know, right, IPv6 is just fundamental. It's like the oxygen to the internet. But let me not get over that, because again, I want to double click on that, because underneath the covers, and again, I think you also hit something that's fundamentally important, which is the MAC address, which is often left out of the TCP/IP discussions, is really the unique identifier that's attached to every single electronic device that exists out there. It's sort of like, it is the UPC to some extent,
right,
for digital devices, but that's the ID for the asset itself or the thing itself.
Right.
And then along comes the IPv4 or IPv6 address now that sort of sits on top of that. That's how it becomes routable, findable, you know, once it gets onto the internet, right?
So we're going back to the OSI model.
Yeah, right, dude. I mean, no. But I mean, on a separate conversation, I've given discussions in the cybersecurity area, and I'm like, dude, I'm going to give you hacking 101. Go learn COBOL or Fortran, right, from the 60s and 70s. You'll be able to hack into more stuff than you realize, because most people have forgotten those languages, yet they're still the core of so many mainframe-type things that are sitting out there. But okay.
Which is in retail, yeah, right? Retail is still very heavy mainframe. Very
don't just shows most governments have heavy mainframe. Most securities heavy mainframe. I mean, it's in that sense, it's a very fragile world. Oh, but anyway, okay. So, but now kind of bring it back to GS1 and what you guys are doing, and the broader context of the supply chain circularity conundrum, which is, you know, what Cisco and what the creation of the internet itself, right, to kind of be able to bring this disparate digital world all together, routable, findable. We're trying to figure out how to layer that out into the physical world, onto each individual right. physical thing. That is literally the problem statement that's in front of us for the next 30, 40 years, right? And you guys are in the middle of that, but a little, and it's amazing that you've got 114, I'm assuming, again, when you say member organizations, that makes me think now you're in 114 countries out of 210 or whatever number we're at these days. Smart, because now you got flexibility in the regionality of the issues that are coming up, because that's constantly changing, right? The laws, the regulations. I mean, data sharing 10 years ago was a lot simpler than data sharing today, where all these regulations are starting to show up. And God only knows, in 10 years from now, it, you know, data wars is a real thing. But let me get back to where I'm going, which is GS1 sits at this really interesting, been around for a long time. You know, it's kind of, you know, like you said, 50, 60 years old organization. Most people have never, ever, ever heard of it, but it is one of the standards body that potentially and is leading the charge towards creating the visible, transparent supply chain where every asset, IoT enabled, blah, 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 is connected, right?
Yeah. So just a couple of things, Rick, just to kind of level set again. Like, we are a not-for-profit, net-neutral organization. So we're not here to tell industry what to do, but we're bringing industry to the table and pointing out things, right? And then say, industry, you make the decision. We'll help you manage the standard that you want to leverage, what you want to leverage it for, like serialized shipping container code. What needs to be in it? What doesn't need to be in it? How can we transmit this through EPCIS, which are, you know, systems of systems, right? Context is important. And I use this very simple example, context, 01/02/2023. Is that January 2nd or the 1st of February? Because if you live in the United States, that's January 2nd. If you live in England, that's the 1st of February.
Right.
It's the same numbers. How does a computer interpret that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about data science and, you know, machine learning and all these things. Data scientists still spend 75 to 90% of their time doing ETLs, extract, transform, and load, right?
Yep.
Take the information out, transform it so it's all aligned. We're using the same dates, right? Are we using a Mr. or a Mrs. or a doctor or nothing? Are we using first names and last names with initials? Like, that's the ETL work that has to be done. To move to automation, machine learning helps do some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you can anticipate it faster, it will all work faster. And so now I take a step back. In the last few years, we've been doing a lot with e-commerce, right?
Yep.
And the whole, especially with COVID, it just really shot out the whole direct-to-consumer business.
Yep.
Which was around half.
Yep.
But direct-to-consumer brands will tell us, oh, we don't work in retail. We don't need a barcode.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're just going to go here. And then we flip around to them and say, okay, I totally appreciate where you're coming from, but aren't you keeping your products in warehouses? Well, we are. Okay. Well, do you manage those warehouses? Oh, no, we outsource those warehouses. Okay.
Right.
Well, what if I told you you could have a barcode, a UPC that is interoperable, can move in and out of any warehouse you want it to across the globe. And oh, by the way, when some major retailer calls you and says, we saw your product, we love it, can we get it in our stores? You can say yes and go in that day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what we saw happening was anyone that came from retail set themselves up that way. Anyone that jumped right into direct to consumer, you know, products, the warehouse would say, hey, we need to put a barcode on your package in order to keep it here. We can do that for you. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then the retailer would call and say, hey, we saw your product. We'd love to have it in our stores. They say, great. We need a UPC barcode. Great. We have a barcode. This is the key. Retailer asked for a UPC barcode. Brand said, great. We have a barcode. That's the detail that people miss. They do have a barcode. It's a proprietary barcode that was put in for a closed loop system.
Yep.
And it worked.
Yep.
Once you had to take it outside, it doesn't work. And this is where sustainability and circularity come into play. There are brands and retailers out there for a long, long time. They've been closed loop systems. They make their own product. They distribute their own product. They sell their own product. They can have proprietary numbers. It works for them.
Yep.
That's their own private, local area, wide area network. That's what it is. You can talk any language you want it to talk. But now if you want to move into sustainability and circularity, well, then I need to know where you're getting stuff from and you need to share that. I need to know how to recycle, repurpose, reuse, resell, dispose of, and I need to open that up to folks. So now their proprietary numbers need to be a little bit more open. So it goes back to our original talks, which I've loved, Richard, which is Novell Network, Token Ring, Banyan Vines. Those are three separate networks. And if you had to do a, mergers and acquisitions, well, guess what? You need to pick one of them because it was Beta and VHS. You need to pick one of them and put everyone on it.
Great.
So let me
jump in here, and I'm always happens, man. I'm looking at the clock. Oh, Jesus Christ! But
yeah, we're running out of-
I got so much I want to get into this. So all right, so let me see if I can be efficient with my questions. So number one, so you at GS1 though, right? And you kind of reference this, like when I look at the IEEE, that's a comparative organization that's creating electronic standards for around the world, right? Or, I mean, there are examples of this that exist, right? And you're absolutely correct. You have to, everyone has to agree to participate and agree that the standard is going to be set. It's neutral. It's third party. It's outside of the control of anybody. So I kind of go back to some of my questions about even, you know, the kill or be killed mentalities of Chambers and Ballmer versus Robbins and Nadal today, who are collaborative, open, sharing. You know, he who learns to share in this new collaborative world will be the winner, right? But we're still fighting, like you said, these legacy thinking. That's what's keeping us held back. It's the status quo mentality that I'm a Fortune 50 company, therefore my supply chain is proprietary. I don't want anybody else to know about any unique ID or tag that's on it, right? I think it's that simple. Like, that's what's holding us back from literally standardizing the world's supply chain. It has nothing to do with the technology. It has nothing to do with the ability to create standards. It has nothing to do even with, you know, we're missing something. It's all there. It's just people haven't figured out it's okay to share this stuff.
I think it's that it's okay to share this stuff. Yeah, it's also the age-old thing of how do we bring tons of different point of views together and decide on which one's the right one. When you still have some folks out there that are like, I want to do this. Great. That's a great idea. Can we open it up to everyone? Well, then how am I going to make money?
Right. But this is the thing for VIP, though. That's what I'm kind of like trying to use the analogy.
Yeah.
It's like, we've solved this before. It's happened before.
We have solved this before. But let's take another approach here, right? You know,
yep.
There's so much to unpack here,
yep,
to get into it. And people need to be exposed to other things. And they need, yep, to feel comfortable. And getting comfort takes time. Building trust. So I think when we look at, like, look at the grocery industry and what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other challenge. Let's just call it aspirin, right? You know, it could be any type of product like an aspirin. But
yep. Yep.
You go to the grocery store, you can buy aspirin. You go to the pharmacy, you can buy aspirin. You go, yep, stay in a hospital and they can give you aspirin.
Yep.
Those are almost three different supply chains.
Yep. Totally.
Different groups around the globe dealing with things differently. And this is where we have to start reaching over the lines and learning from one another. I think this is one of the great outcomes. You have a fire. It's devastating. It's tragic. It's terrible. But after a fire in the wilderness, you also have new flowers. You have new growth. You have new birth. Mm-hmm. There's always something good to come from the bad. And I think from COVID, this is kind of one of the good things. The amount of people taking master's programs in supply chain quadrupled since COVID. Supply chain is now part of a conversation at the chairman level, at the board level. So these things, they were happening before, but they weren't looked at the right way. And we have the physical and digital supply chains.
I love that term.
Really starting to merge and change. And, you know, we talk about digital twins, but what does that mean? And now the way we do things today in terms of identifying products, we might have to look at it a little bit differently as we go forward, because especially with sustainability. So I'm holding up a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
This is a product made of product, right? I have a camera, I have a battery, I have wireless antennas in here and lots of other circuitry. Okay, so are those products at some point in the supply chain system, that is the manufactured product, and yes, this manufactured product is a conglomerate of all those manufactured products, but I only have an identifier for this.
Correct.
So when we start looking at it, and you're seeing it in Europe, digital product passports that are needed for batteries now, and they're looking at toys and other things moving forward. They're looking at construction. What materials are in the homes and going into the homes so we can keep track of it with the thought of the experience we had with asbestos. When asbestos came out, it was a wonder product. Fire retardant, light, flexible, malleable, all these great things. We didn't know it created cancer.
Yep.
Now we do. So now do we keep it? Do we embed it? Do we extract it? They're already thinking we're going to need to be prepared for that so we can look at a digital file, a digital twin, and say, oh, okay, we know what's where and what's what. So it's...
Totally. But you also... But okay, so again, I want to highlight something that you went over pretty quickly, though, which is part of the collaborative kind of abilities to think differently today, even at a corporate development, and this is more kind of just I'm giving some shout outs to people who are thinking about how to follow in either your footsteps or kind of create a career in supply chain or what gives advantage today is in most career development. And you highlighted a number of things, even in your own personal experience and in your personal resume, which is you've had a diversity of experiences in multiple industries. And even at GS1, you're looking across horizontally the world's ecosystem of industries. You're not insular in just oil and gas or just technology. Therefore, you're beginning to see patterns that are universal across the whole supply chain. But that requires the diversity of experience that, like you said, specialization 50 years ago was the in thing. I think the pendulum swung the other direction where I'm not sure specialization today is a competitive advantage. I think diversity of experience ultimately is a competitive advantage. I know when I'm hiring, and I'm putting your recruiter hat on, I'm actually looking to see, have you been in multiple fields? I think that's a strike, not a disadvantage.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And you know, you nailed it. We were learning from each other's groups. And then there are some consistent themes. They're consistent. And we're going to need to address them. But I know we're getting tight on time here.
Yeah, we're getting tight on time. So let me wind down a little bit because we're going to get, it's just going to come down to it. But let me sort of ask, so, you know, what people... Parting thoughts, you know, you're at GS1, you're kind of at this career. What's going on with GS1? Because you guys are really leading the charts. Like, what? Where do people find out more about you, find out what's going on in GS1? Because I think people would be interested. And I'm sure you're even seeing inbound inquiries rising with the notoriety that GS1, you know, at the right place at the right time with supply chain digitization going on right now. Like, so, you know, people love to hear it. Like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of like one of those things where, you know, somebody in your family buys a new car, you'd never seen it before, and then you leave the house and then you see like seven of them on the road. You start to realize that's what's happening here. I think for us, it's really about get involved, get engaged. Go to gs1us.org. We have work groups. We have initiatives. We do pilots. A lot of people don't realize, but like we're doing pilots with computer vision companies, startups, universities, enterprises that are well-known household name companies and brands, bringing everyone together and looking at net new ways of trying to do things. What other information can we get involved with? We've been working with the apparel industry on looking at recycling. What needs to be shared? What doesn't? But it takes involvement. I think that this is the piece that comes back, you know, with our parents. And, you know, you would see folks that were involved in the community. And sometimes you're like, why would they do that? But I finally reached that maturity in my life of like, this is why, right?
Yeah.
And I try to tell people, a rising tide is going to lift all boats, but the boats still need to go to the marina and the marina standards, right?
Yep.
So I know what I'm getting to. I know there's going to be water. I know there's going to be power. I know there's going to be tie-off cleats for my boat, but it's standards because I'm not bringing a container ship to a regional marina, all right? And I'm not bringing, you know, my little pontoon boat to a container dock. We need to have standards along the way and communicate and best practices and lean in. And we can absolutely learn from other scenarios. And this is why I'm so passionate about it, is that the technology education I got, I was in the trenches as it was happening, moving from one environment to another. And these were companies that are like, whoa, 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 if you do that, I lose my competitive edge. But we have to find other ways, like you talked about, you know, with Microsoft and Cisco now and their leadership and how they're doing open standards and sharing information and trying different tactics. That's it. We have to evolve. We need, as they say in neuroscience, plasticity.
Yes.
We need plasticity to bend and flex and regrow new connections.
I love it. On that note, Reed, incredible episode. I got to wind it down. Really, just a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for the time.
Yeah, really, just awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much.